From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 285, recorded live Thursday, September 22nd, 2011. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Control, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Kendall Miller, founder of Gibraltar Software.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. We continue the startup series that will go indefinitely. I don't know, whenever I run out of startups. But we're having fun so far, and today we're going to be talking with Kendall Miller. He's the principal and the founder of Gibraltar, making .NET software. How's it going, Kendall?
It's going great. How are you doing, Scott?
Very well, very well. So you have a startup, and how old is your company now?
So we shipped the first commercial version of Gibraltar just a little over 2 years ago. We've actually been working at this a little over 3.5, but it's great to benchmark from the first time you start asking people to pay for what you're doing. And so that's been a little over 2 years.
Okay, so you've been asking people to pay for software for 2 years. But how did you fund it? How did you start this? And how many people are you now?
So we got we were really lucky. I was coming out of another startup situation where basically we were, you know, the company was selling out, and I was not one of the owners, but I participated very heavily in the project. So I got a bit of a bump out of that and decided that fundamentally I really enjoyed doing startups. And so I looked around for an opportunity and teamed back up with a partner that I'd worked with at a previous project. And we penciled around and really started just saying we're going to make a consulting company. But the more we worked at it, the more we realized that we've done consulting. What we really wanted to do was software product work, and got going with that. And we funded it primarily ourselves for the first 2 years. And then we lapsed into a little bit of friends and family financing, the classics there. But it is essentially all self-funded internally.
And when you're funding something like this, like if I quit today and I want to go into a startup, is it as simple as, you know, I get $400 or $500, I get a copyright, I buy a website, and I just continue to pay the rent? Or, I mean, how much money should I set aside for two guys for 2 years?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's a lot harder than that. To give you an idea, even on a small scale, by the time you get to the point where the company's cash positive, or, you know, ramen profitable, each month you're bringing enough revenue to pay yourself enough to eat ramen and stay alive, you're usually talking hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Really?
And the reason is that you've got to do a lot more than just have a website up to be a presence, unless you already are. Like you yourself, you could do this pretty inexpensively because you're who you are and you already have an audience listening to you and what you're and interested in what you're doing next and all of that. But most folks don't have that. So you end up putting a tremendous amount of energy into being somebody and getting anybody's attention for what you're doing. And that requires a lot of just time and money over time. You know, we budget between $3,000 and $5,000 a month on a couple different types of marketing we do, and we've been doing that for over 2 years. That adds up because you're doing that even if you don't get any revenue in. Plus, you've got to, you know, have yourself and a couple other folks. It takes a number of people to pull off a real product that can sell in today's market. And even if you're willing to not pay yourself, which is where we were for the first 2 years, you still have a lot of expenses to be enough of a real company that people will be willing to make an investment in you, which is what you're asking when you ask them to pay for your software or service.
You know how when you kind of drive through parts of town you've never been at before, and maybe you'll be driving along and you'll see a place like, you know, come in and do pottery. Yeah, come in and paint your own pot. And you think to yourself, okay, these guys are paying $2,000 a month in rent, and they want to charge me $10 to go and paint this little ceramic pot. It's going to take, you know, 200 of these little ceramic pots before they even hit the rent, much less pay for stuff. I mean, I'm sure I must not be the only person that does that. And don't you just count the number of little pots they have to sell and think, how are these people in business a day?
That's right. And in fact, it's one of the scariest things about getting going because in many ways, for example, we set our pricing about our market. So we sell to the .NET tool space, and that has pre-established price bands for what people will pay for tools in the .NET development space. So pretty much our pricing bands were set before we sold license one or had one line of code written. And we looked at that, and we did the math and said, wow, we're going to have to sell X licenses a day to break even. and you start thinking about X people in the world have to find my product and love it enough to pull out a credit card each day for us to break even. And it's mind-boggling. But the amazing part is, particularly in like the market of .NET, is that there's so many people worldwide in that space that there are tons and tons of prospects if you have a product worth getting. And that's really the challenge, like the pottery thing or whatever, is there's got to be enough people in your area that want to do pottery that will happen. And you also have to be willing to say at a certain point, you know what, it turns out, well, I love pottery and you love pottery. There's only so many little ceramic frogs and cups that we can have in our house. This is it. We can't make this be viable. But it is, it's daunting. In fact, you know, for us, we couldn't even conceive of what that would look like. But I will say it's happened. I mean, we see month after month more and more folks buying licenses, more and more folks buying our products as more people hear about it. And you just have to have sort of faith that that will come around, and you won't have any idea where those people are coming from in most of the time. They're just showing up. But you have to be able to persevere long enough in the market for that to happen. And that's really, I think, the biggest challenge is it's not the launching the product. A good rule of thumb that we've seen in our own, and I've heard from talking to a lot of other entrepreneurs, is it takes about 18 months from when you first start charging and you're really full bore in the market before mm-hmm. you're generating enough sales on a monthly basis to pay for your costs. And we're not being extravagant about our costs. We're watching it very carefully. But we're still, and that was about what it took for us to get there. So we had to survive in a loss mode for that long before it even started breaking even, let alone paying back the investment we put in to get to there.
Yeah, and that's the tragic thing about like losses. Like the math doesn't quite work. I mean, if you have a bad month, not only do you have to dig out of that bad month, but then you also have to do great the next month. It's like, I remember when I was working as a teenager in retail, and one of the first things they explained to you is how bad it is when someone steals. When someone steals something, it's not just that you lose the profit, you lose the thing that, the money it costs to buy that thing, you know what
right.
I mean? And then you have to go and sell five more to pay for that one that got stolen, et cetera, et cetera. So I wonder, when you worry about your startup, do you wonder that tomorrow no one will buy the product? And that's it. We just saturated the market. It was a Tuesday. And now it's Tuesday in September, and all everyone's bought it. It's over.
And I'll tell you what, that relates to one of our biggest surprises moving from the consulting business or the internal corporate mm-hmm. development world into commercial software was we were used to in consulting that you look out about 3-4 months and there's nothing there, right? No, you don't know where that contract's coming from, but it always seems to show up by the time you kind of get close and there and on you go, and you're always busy. Mm-hmm. With software sales, we thought we're building this asset, we'll have this marketing machine, people will be lining up, it'll be a steady stream of purchases, it'll all be good. Instead, what we found is literally every day we go, that's great, wow, today was amazing, we just blew the doors off. What'll tomorrow be? And tomorrow could be zero. It could absolutely, mm-hmm. absolutely would happen. Microsoft, when they shipped Visual Studio 2010, that April,
mm-hmm.
we went through 6 weeks where there was nothing. All of our web stats just flatlined.
Mm.
And in retrospect, it makes some sense. That's .NET 4, Visual Studio 2010. Everybody in our market stopped, paused, and said, what does this mean to me when the whole Visual Studio changes and .NET Framework and all of that? And they stopped looking at anything else that's secondary, like tooling and the rest of it, before they figured out, what did this mean for me? Then they picked it back up, and sales actually picked up, and we had a good summer. But there were 6 weeks there where the crickets were chirping and we could have turned the lights off. And that's very nerve-wracking. You have to have a certain faith that it will eventually come back. And it did. We're seeing a bit of that now in the shadow of Build. I'm not surprised. This time we're kind of ready for it. We actually budgeted for it that, okay, mm-hmm. after Build, we're going to allow 4 to 6 weeks of quiet and just expect it. So we're not going to freak out when that happens. But it means that you're also, when you have a good month, you're stocking that away in a war chest, just mm-hmm. waiting for a bad month.
The other thing that I worry about if one were to put together a product is the support burden.
Mm-hmm.
And this might sound silly, but if your product sucks or if you have a bad release or something goes wrong, it seems like the amount of money it would cost just to interact with someone is going to take away from the sales. Like I always think about how hard the credit card people and the bank people try to keep us from talking to another human. Someone told me once it was like $8 if you call the bank and speak to a human.
Right.
Like that's how much it costs for the entire process before the human shows up. So they do everything they can to prevent you from talking to another human. But at the same time, that's how you build relationships. So how do you balance support burden? I'm sure you have like those customers that just won't leave you alone. They call you daily.
I'll tell you what, here's the thing that we've done, and it's very counterculture, but it has worked out really well for us, which is that we make it as ridiculously easy as possible to get a hold of us and take advantage of us in that regard. And there's a couple reasons for it. We got some great advice early on from another entrepreneur who said, when we were worried about the scalability of our customer service, he said, okay, let's say that this guy calls, and let's say that he actually calls you on the phone and he spends an hour asking you about something that's only remotely related to what you guys have sold him.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you know that that's not the best hour you can spend right now to help him out? So because who knows who else he's going to talk to? Who knows where he's going to go from that? So what we instead did was focused, instead of sort of trying to avoid providing direct customer service or finding ways to cleverly dodge it, we have lots of channels to let people get a hold of us. And we focused in is trying to solve their question as fast as possible. So by being as effective as we can, we try to control our costs that way. And one of the things we do there that has been actually brilliant for us is we're really big on whatever screen share technology the person wants to use. We have GoToMeeting set up as well as LiveMeeting and JoinMe. Mm-hmm. And there's all these services, right? So we're very quick. If you like do a live chat with us through our website, you will probably get me or the other partner or the lead developer because we're the ones who monitor that. Because we want to make sure that we can give you the best, fastest answer. We'll really quickly, though, if you're having an issue anywhere near our product, say, hey, let's set up a screen share. And we want to see what you're doing. Because what we've discovered is when you're watching how someone got themselves into trouble, that is more interesting than just making this ticket go away. Now, that may not be true of credit card processing, but it's really interesting for us to see, for example, how people got themselves in trouble in .NET and what are the crazy things that they're trying to accomplish that we hadn't thought of.
Mm.
And that generates a huge amount of our product feedback that goes into our backlog and what we prioritize to actually develop. Because a lot of times people will get into a problem over in one corner, but they got there because they didn't do several things several steps back or they didn't see another way around to not have the problem in the first place. And when you see their screen and see what they're trying to do, it hits you what's going on and how you could really make a difference to those people. And the other thing, finally, from that is there's no one's used to that. So for us, it means that our customers are raving fans of our ability to provide support. And frankly, as a startup, we've gotten away with some stuff that should not have gone wrong in our code because we've absolutely stood behind it to make it right. And that's a trade-off you can make as a startup, right? Because what you have is you have some time and you have some smart people that are readily available, so capitalize on that. It may not scale up to, it certainly doesn't scale up to Microsoft size, but it may not scale up to even mid-sized company size, but you're not a mid-sized company yet, right? So instead, we're just trying to make raving fans of everyone we can come in contact with. And so from that, we make it really easy to get a hold of us. And we make it really easy to get support from us, and we'll go very far to help people out. There will come a time that may change a little bit, but frankly, that's sort of part of who we are now.
Mm-hmm. Well, the question of scale that you just brought up was exactly where I was going with my next question, which was, that won't scale. Like, you know, Bill Gates doesn't answer the phone anymore, right? He did,
but now
he doesn't. How big can you get? And what are you trying to do? Like, I always like the idea of building what I call a boutique. And I mean, you know, 3-4 guys that can last and pay everyone's rent and pay everyone's mortgage, and then, you know, you don't have to work 60 hours a week. That would be great.
Right. So our goal, and we set this out ahead of time, was that if we had any one software product that needed more than 25 total people, we were going to try to sell it. Because that's not the business we wanted to be in.
Mm.
Because once you get to that point, you've got to be a couple clicks up from what's actually going on in the product, and that's less interesting to us. Now, maybe in 5 years, I'll say it's not 25, it's 50 or it's 100. But we really like to be involved, be able to be involved with customers when we choose to. But yeah, things are going to change over time where it may not be you get a hold of me. It may be you get that you know, I'm not behind live chat. It'll be other folks. You already have the engineers involved, and it'll trickle down. And there may come some time where that actually goes to sales and a bit of a triage. But I want to defer that as far as I can because I think it's such a differentiator. And I'll give you an example of another company I think does really well at this. DevExpress is a big company. But when you go onto their forums, now it's not live chat and it's not a phone call, but if you go onto their forums and you post a question about one of their products, the folks that answer that are the development team that's actually writing that little product, part of the product, and they get back to you just immediately on stuff. You may not like their answer, And I think sometimes the answers change as the companies get bigger. You don't have the ability to say, you bet we'll fix that and we'll send you something in a week or less. But you can still instill in your culture that we support our customers fundamentally attitude. I got my career started at John Deere, it's a huge company, and one of the things that the first things they taught us when we came in, and I didn't know anything about John Deere's equipment, was I had to learn all the names of the things because they said, look, you're going to be on a plane somewhere and someone's going to find out you work for John Deere and they're going to say, hey, I love John Deere, I've got this X, but there's one thing and there's some problem. You need to know what to ask, what to get, because if someone speaks to anyone at John Deere, it's as if they spoke to everyone at John Deere. And we had a whole protocol for what we did to get back and make sure that that person got taken care of by their local dealer and it was dealt with. And that's a huge, you know, that's a Fortune 100 company. But they had a system to make sure that that was who we were. And frankly, you get your career started in a place like that, you just can't let it go.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
My hope is that we will always be able to provide that level of service. We'll just change the tactics we use to deliver it in ways that are more cost-effective at scale.
Hi, this is Scott coming to you from another place in time. Are you using agile practices to manage your software development? There's lots of tools in the market that manage the steps of a project, but most of them focus on individual roles. Get ready for a solution that caters for the success of the whole team. The guys at Telerik introduced TeamPulse. It's an agile project management tool that'll help you gather ideas, estimate, plan, track progress in a common workspace. Finally, companies, regardless of their size, can use a lightweight and convenient tool that makes all the stakeholders work as a united team, even if they're in different countries. By combining intuitive user interface and the power of Silverlight, TeamPulse removes the roadblocks that you typically face in applying Agile in an effective manner. No more lost data, no disparate systems, no lack of critical analytics regarding the health and velocity of your project. See for yourself. Get a free copy for 5 users and 1 project at Telerik.com/TeamPulse. And please do thank Telerik for supporting Hansel Minutes on their Facebook fan page, facebook.com/TELERIK, Telerik. We do appreciate it. There wouldn't be a Hansel Minutes if there wasn't Telerik helping us. So one of the things we haven't talked about yet is what exactly you make. So very briefly, what did you build and what are you selling?
Sure. So we have 2 software products in the .NET market. So we sell to .NET developers. We have 2 products. One, our namesake product, Gibraltar, is a logging and application monitoring platform. It's basically a little agent, a little black box you drop into any .NET app, gathers data, lets it send it back to a server, and you pull it down into a client where you can do all kinds of analytics on how features people use, how well it performs, who your users are, how often they run the app. You can also do that critical error defect triage process, what kind of errors are people getting in the field, what do they correlate to, that type of information. And that's the first one we developed internally. And along the way, about a year ago, we actually acquired another product from another company called VistaDB, and that's now part of our family as well, because we really love the product. We actually use it in Gibraltar, so when we had the opportunity to pick it up, we went for it. And that is basically is a miniature version of SQL Server that runs in your .NET application. It's a 1-meg assembly that emulates much of the language and capabilities of SQL Server. So if you develop for it, you can switch around and just change a couple ADO options, and you are going against SQL Server. And that sells, that frankly, actually now, in terms of users, it outsells Gibraltar about 2-to-1, because a lot of people have that need, and we love that product. They both fit in this family, though, of what we wanted to have our company be about, which is not front-end components for .NET developers, but what we call rock-solid components, things that are foundational that go underneath that make it really work so that mid-size and small companies can develop solutions that just deliver for their customers and can afford to do it.
But it seems like, so you've got a logging tool and you've got an embedded database.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't Microsoft coming in? Doesn't Microsoft have SQL Compact and some logging blocks, and then you've got Log4Net and all those other kind of things like Elma? I mean, you're basically describing like the 2 most useful and general things that people have. But I don't, you know, if Microsoft comes out with a product like that, they're not trying to kill you. They may not even know you exist. They're just saying, well, there's a need. So then they decide to do it. But doesn't that go like when SQL Compact 4 came out, weren't you just like, oh no, it's over.
There's always a moment, right, where you see, oh my gosh, did they do that? And this Compact 4 is a good example because it addressed a number of deficiencies of the previous version of SQL Compact. In fact, I would say that SQL Compact 3.5 was the best advertisement for VistaDB there was, because it got people thinking they could do it, and then they realized the limitations and came looking for us. But the good news is that unlike Microsoft, there's the threshold I need for of annual sales for a business to be really worth it is relatively low. You know, if something generates, say, $1 million or $2 million in sales a year, that's a pretty good business that I would be willing to be in. From a Microsoft standpoint, or even a mid-sized software company, that's not worth it. That's not even worth the marketing budget. So that's great because it means that we can just focus in on what we do. And there's always that pang and that fear. But if you talk about like VistaDB, we've really focused in on being the most deployable SQL Server engine that you can buy because we have the best compatibility with the full-up SQL Server like SQL Express. And SQL Express is free to purchase, but it's a large download that has to be installed and run as a service. And for a lot of applications, that's not workable. Now, where it is, that's great, but we provide an option that really runs for that lower scale for folks that can't do that. And there's a lot of those folks out there. Likewise, I'll tell you, on the logging side, when we got started with Gibraltar, one of the assumptions we made was that nobody would buy a log viewer, that that was something we had to have a great log viewer in there, but nobody would spend even $1 for the world's most singing, dancing, beautiful log viewer. Ironically, our feedback from our first 9 months of sales were people bought it strictly as a log viewer. So that assumption we had was flat wrong when we actually talked to our customers.
That's interesting because you got them to buy it, which is which is an achievement, but then they went and used it in a way you didn't expect, which seems to be a common thing in startups. Like you have a vision, you execute on some fraction of that vision, you think you've got a lot of success, and then you start talking to the customers and you realize that they really expected a different thing and they even took the product in a different direction.
Absolutely. And what I like to tell people is that up to the moment you ship the first commercial release, it's all about your vision. What do you think this should be? You have to put something in for people to build around and get and glom onto. But once it ships, you need to start listening really carefully to what do they tell you its value proposition is all about. What do they tell you it really is? So for the first version we put out, what they told us is, this is a great log viewer. I'm plugging this into Log4Net and using it to view my Log4Net data because it's so much better than the other Log4Net viewing options I have. But I really wish it did these three things. And from that, we came out with essentially our 2.5 version, which did those things. And now we get different feedback from folks on what they're using it for. And about every year, it cycles a little bit. And we're adjusting where the product goes because of that. But at the same time, we're also recognizing that customers are good at telling you how to refine where you are and telling you how they're using what you're doing, but they're not good at making discontinuous jumps to new capabilities. So, for example, we've actually taken now two swings at a certain set of functionality, and we know that both those swings are not widely used by our customers, but the ones that have adopted it really love it. So our next major version of Gibraltar, which is coming out late this year, takes a third swing at that basic problem, which is error management, and does it in a different way based on that feedback. We integrated a lot of error management into the system, but we assumed everyone used a defect tracking system. We said, you know what, we don't want to have our own thing. We're going to integrate with your defect tracking system. Now, it turns out that while I've always used a defect tracking system, most companies don't use a real defect tracking system. Most of our customers, turned out, don't use a real defect tracking system. They use Excel. So what they really needed was they needed us to have that capability built in, not leverage the external defect tracking system. Other than the folks that really do have one, and for them, it's a deal breaker if it doesn't integrate. And that's some of the challenges you run into.
All right. Now, notice that you do a lot of community stuff. You go to a lot of events. You speak at a lot of events and stuff like that. Is that a part of the business strategy, or is that just your personality?
You know, I justify it to my partner and to the rest of the company that that's all part of our marketing strategy. In fact, I think I steal like 2/3 of our marketing budget to pay for trips and sponsorships and things like that. But to be totally honest, I do because I love the people. It is. There's nothing like getting out and meeting the community. I wish I'd started doing it a lot earlier than I did, because there's so much going on, and you can really hear from other people, not just the headline, hey, this worked great, I loved how this new technology, this new approach works, but you also can have a conversation with them and find out, yeah, well, there were all these little issues that didn't work out so well, and here's what we had to do, and all of that. And there's so many passionate folks around the .NET community space, both here and over in Europe. That I've met, that it really motivates us to do more and do better, and test out ideas and talk to these people to see where they're going. And they're usually well ahead. I'll tell you what, the folks that go to community events, that's a pretty self-selecting group. Those folks are the tip of the spear. They're well ahead of the main part of the market. But that's good because it's a small company. It may take me a year or a year and a half to react and assimilate that kind of feedback and have something actually out in the market for it.
Mm. Do you think that that's an urgent thing that other people should think about? Because one of the things that you mentioned a little bit earlier in the show was that getting people to actually hear about your stuff. Like, you might have something amazing and no one will hear about it. I mean, I was actually speaking at a government agency yesterday and I was showing them some different things that Microsoft sells or gives away in this case, and they'd never heard of them. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, if Microsoft can't get the message out, how is like Joe software company supposed to, you know, and is talking to the community the best way, or is it advertisements in dead tree newspapers, or, you know, what's the best way for a startup? Because there's so many, let me put it this way. If you look at an open source project as a startup, just a smaller scale, I get probably 12, 13 emails a week of like, hey, take a look at this open source project, try to get it off the ground. And you just wonder, why do 100 like languish? Just sit in GitHub or CodePlex with no one using them, a couple hundred downloads, and then other ones take off. It makes me wonder if marketing matters at all. Maybe it's all just word of mouth and marketing is all a lie.
Well, I would say that marketing is all of those pieces, and if you cannot market your product, you, at best, will be the coolest product no one ever heard of. And you're right that even big companies can have trouble with this. Microsoft, I think, from my standpoint, the biggest challenge of Windows Phone 7 is exactly one of marketing. If you can't get people to try it, it doesn't matter how great it is.
Right.
Now, in each specific product space, you're going to have certain unique marketing challenges. But as a small company, one of the greatest lies that we tell future entrepreneurs often is, oh, yeah, well, now with the Internet, it's a great level. You just put up a website, and Google will index it, and you're golden. Maybe buy some AdWords.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? That just doesn't pan out at all. You can find ways to generate traffic in a short burst if you get lucky. Like, let's say you were to post something about Gibraltar at the top of your blog. I guarantee you for 3-4 days, we would get a huge spike of traffic. I also would bet you solidly that if I look back 6 months later, it would make virtually no difference in our sales.
Exactly. Exactly. People are always like, oh, great, thanks for tweeting my thing. I was like, well, you know, of the 100 people that visited it, maybe one person installed it. You know, I mean, conversion ratios are just horrible. People are
horrible.
Happy to look at stuff, but to actually get someone to take an action is a hugely difficult thing.
So here's the metric, and I think it's really important for startups to spend energy on trying to develop a metric or a yardstick to measure what you're doing. And frankly, be willing to try just about anything if you can measure it. So, for example, we actually stopped doing a lot of our internet advertising and redirected all of that money into funding community events. But it had provided us a metric, which was $3 per person we talk to. And we used to talk to pretty generally. Like, you know, I'll spend $3 to at least exchange email with somebody that I've never, you know, back and forth, or a live chat or an actual, you know, live demo. And so we thought about it and we said, you know what, geez, if we spend $1,000 to sponsor at a code camp and we get 100 people to walk by the booth, which is easy to do, what does that cost? That costs us $10 a person. All right. Well, if we also speak at that camp, there's another 100 people that may be in that room, or there maybe it's 50 or whatever it is. What's that costing us per person that we're talking to? And we use that sort of as our quality bar because it really is about creating those conversations. In the end, people buy from other people. That's what happens. So you have to find some way of being a person to them or being somebody they know or feel like trying out. We find at the moment for us right now, community events are a good channel for that. If I was developing billing software for dentists, I would be finding every dental conference that there was. I'd find the local association of dental professionals or whatever it is in Spokane and go there and talk with them. And you have no idea quite how those are going to pan out. So you sort of have to just keep plugging away at that, but finding some way of measuring it to adjust over, say, 3 or 6 months what you're doing and keep mixing it up. We do get some feedback that says, for example, with community events, the first time we go to a community event, particular one, maybe a code camp, we get very little traction. When we show up the second or third time, we get a lot of traction. People are looking that you're committed to their community, their space, to do something before they take you seriously. But in the tool space, we think that that's effective. That said, I would be hard pressed to prove it. And as a computer developer, I don't like things I can't prove. But the reality of it is, that's marketing. You need to focus not on traffic, though. That's the challenge. And, you know, you talk about a tweet or being at the top of a blog post. That's about just generating traffic. There's nothing wrong with traffic intrinsically, but traffic doesn't actually move your business forward on its own.
That is really the conclusion almost right there. I mean, go where they are. right? Mm-hmm. Go where the developers are. We've been talking about that ourselves. I was at TechEd recently with Damian Edwards, and we found a couple of ladies that worked for a government agency, and they'd been using WebForms since 2004. And they'd never heard of Scott Goo, and they'd never heard of me, and they'd never read a book, and they just basically, you know, they'd done web forms for, you know, almost 10 years and had no idea that this community existed.
Mm-hmm.
So then now our challenge is, well, we met them at this conference. It was the first conference I'd ever gone to. But our question is then, where are these people hanging out? You know, where do they go? They don't go to code camps, you know? So
right.
do we have to go to their place of business at this point?
You know, that's a real challenge. Many computing professionals don't go to anything. They go to work and then they go home. Now they may not be the best folks to reach out to. You want to find the folks on the bubble, right? That would be, if they realized there was something available to them, they would make that extra effort to go and do it. But the government sector is very isolated. The public sector and the private sector are really have very different criteria for making decisions. We do sell to both sectors, and it's very interesting. Here's the completely different decision matrices on those two sides.
Right.
And on the public sector, you really do have a different way of reaching in that emphasizes working in that government space, and it's very long term. But yeah, it's a big challenge to get into those organizations. If we back off from public sector, which is so specialized that you just have to have a dedicated organization that just thinks like that and works in that space. How do you get yourself into those environments beyond code camps and the like? Well, you do have to keep asking yourself, where are these people going, or what are they looking at, and how do I put an ad in their way? And it may be that you have, for example, an ad on Stack Overflow that's leading to something else because, gosh, if they search a problem, they may well end up at Stack Overflow. If that type of user is a good fit for what you're doing, or you may end up in a situation where it's not about technology users groups, but about going to the end customer groups. The government sector does have all kinds of groups that worry about all sorts of things, but they tend to not have these pure technology groups. Now, some real large companies do, though. They'll actually have internal groups. I know a lot of the pharmaceutical companies, for example, have internal groups that just worry about technology and pharma.
Mm-hmm.
And those are some interesting groups to get into, because once you can get any connection into that space, there's a lot of people there, and they tend to look at what each other do to pick their products and pick what to move forward with, because you must have already gone through a lot of the problems that it takes to get into that space.
They follow the crowd.
Yeah. Because the other thing the other little dirty secret about buying software, about using software, and it's probably true, really, it's really true of most products, is that nobody really has the time or the need to make a completely, what you might call well-informed purchase decision. In other words, if you go out and you need a grid control, your boss might say, okay, well, we need to find the best grid control for the least money to solve this application. But I can guarantee you, you're not actually going to download each and every possible grid control, open source and closed source, test them all out, find out which one is exactly the very best for your need, and then go with that one. You're going to find some way of substituting them to some things that you feel you could live with, seeing if they appear that they're going to work, and you're willing to put your name behind them, that those are worthy solutions. In the end, are you willing to have your reputation attached to that option? That's what people really work, whether it's buying cars or buying grids or buying logging systems. And so what you need to get them to do is feel good enough with you that they're willing to put their reputation at stake a bit for you. And that's one of the reasons why we focus so much on our service side, our customer support side, is I want to make sure people feel like even if something's not quite right, they'll be able to work with us and be able to get it right. And as a small company, the thing is, as a startup, that's something you can do that the big established players cannot do. They just can't afford it. Oracle can't afford to provide that type of personal service at no cost. But you can. So use that advantage to compensate for the disadvantage you have as a small startup that Oracle does not have.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of information there. Do you have any other presentations of yourself talking about startups online that people who are listening might want to check out? Because
I do talk about this at a lot of code camps and other community organizations. If you go to mm-hmm. our blog, either from the www.gibraltarsoftware.com site, okay. or just go straight to it at rocksolid.gibraltarsoftware.com, you'll actually find all the slide decks of each of the talks I've been at and a list of event schedules. Because I may be talking in your area, and I would really love to make the connection and have a chat, whether you're doing a startup now or just thinking about it, or just want to peer over the fence at what it would look like. It's always a lot of great conversation, and that's really why we do it. You know, I'm lucky that I can, as a founder, sort of have the company pay for the things I feel are important. And so for me, I use that to sponsor users groups and community events and go and attend and get and have the opportunity to talk at it. In fact, there are actually some opportunities coming up on the events page right now where I talk about how to set up your own software company and what to take to succeed, both up in New York City at the New York Code Camp and over in the UK coming up later in October.
Very cool. Well, thanks so much for chatting with us today. I appreciate it.
Well, it's been great. Thank you much, Scott.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.